Thank you. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to present my work. And it's been a pleasure to be here for the last couple of months. We've really, both at the professional level, learning more about all these developments in topological physics and condensed matter, and also personal life by being able to go boogie boarding with my children. So today we've heard a lot about the physics of topology, or topological phenomena, that is through the course of this workshop and the conference, that is generically protected, maybe against all perturbations or against all perturbations within some symmetry class. Today, I want to talk about some progress in maybe a slightly different kind of topology. Topology that is a topological phenomena that is associated with the physics of frustration, where by frustration I mean accidental degeneracy, which is something, by definition, which is not generically protected. Now, maybe, but it's not really a full theory at this point, but so maybe we'll have a better sense of what we really mean by protected here. At least for today, we'll think of it as the physics is not generically a kind of topology that somehow is still not generically protected. And that might sound strange, so let me begin by just illustrating what I mean in the context of a simple model, and so maybe it'll make more sense that way. So I'm going to follow Kane and Lubensky's recent paper. They're really the seminal work in this subject. Near the beginning of their paper, they introduce a model of balls and springs. And I'll just try to draw it like this. So we have a bunch of points. On each of these points, we'll attach a spring and a mass. Say something like this. And then between the masses, we'll attach another spring. And so this is a mechanical structure. It looks a lot like a bunch of beams connected by pins. And actually, it was Maxwell who first introduced the idea of beams and pins, and that we can really think of pretty much any mechanical structure in terms of, we can try to model it in terms of a bunch of beams connected by pins. And he said for such things, you can try to understand whether they're, he was interested in the question, this is Maxwell wearing his engineer's hat, right? We know him from other contexts. Here he's trying to understand whether, say, a bridge will collapse or a building will collapse. And so he said, to know whether this is going to be rigid or not, it's not a hard problem. All you have to do is count. Take the number of degrees of freedom and subtract the number of constraints. So in this case, each of these springs will want to be in their rest length if you're at zero energy. At zero energy, the ground states will be configured, will be the case when these springs are at rest length, and it will collapse if you can move these masses without changing the rest lengths of the springs. And so if we have n masses, and in this case I've drawn this in the plane of the board, so I'll think of these masses as being able to move around, then there are 2n degrees of freedom. N is the number of masses, and the number of springs going to depend on boundary conditions, what we do on the ends. So for periodic boundary conditions, you can see that for every mass, there's one spring and another spring. I go to the next mass, there's one spring and another spring. So every mass has exactly two springs. There's two springs for every mass. So there's, with periodic boundary conditions, the number of constraints is also going to be 2n. And so this counting will be zero. Maxwell would say, with periodic boundary conditions, this is a rigid mechanical structure.
Sorry, so those masses are allowed to move in the two-dimensional plane?
In the two-dimensional plane, right. So there's two here is the dimension that they're moving.
So the masses are the dots? Or the
masses are these dots.
And the crosses?
The crosses are like infinite masses. They're stuck in the board. If you have open boundary conditions, you can count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. So in this case, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, we've got 5 masses or 10 degrees of freedom, but only 9 springs on them. And so there's one left over. In other words, 0 for periodic boundary conditions and 1 for open boundary conditions. And so he would immediately say, oh, you open the boundary conditions and the structure stops being rigid. But with closed periodic boundary conditions, the structure is rigid. Now, that's going to turn out to be correct pretty much for this model. But his general argument isn't correct. And it was corrected about almost 40 years ago now by Calladine.
So excuse me, so how did he kind of arrive to this conclusion by using...
This is just, how did he arrive to this conclusion? Let me see. I can tell you intuitively. So you've just got 2n coordinates, and for each constraint, you essentially lose. Each constraint is a statement that the extension of spring m is equal to zero. So you, to satisfy that condition, you lose one coordinate. And so presumably, when you have open boundary conditions, you just don't have enough conditions to remove all the coordinates.
So this is like pretty much like the SPD? Periodic boundary condition, you don't have any degree of freedom.
It sounds like it. It does. Except that I haven't introduced any symmetry yet. So Calladine in 1978 said, actually, this is not quite right. There are ways you can have your constraints do not always have to be cooperative with each other. Sometimes some of the constraints can be completely redundant. So if I added in, say, an extra spring between these two masses, it would be just totally redundant, for example. That's a trivial way of seeing that. So there can be lots of redundant conditions. And so he upgraded Maxwell counting. And it turns out, in a more modern language introduced by Shane and Lubensky, you can think of what he did as upgrading it to a topological index. So if NB is number of bonds or number of springs, and D times N, this D is the number of dimensions of space. In this case, it was 2. He showed that this is actually not the number of zero modes, but number of zero modes minus the number of something else, which he called state of self-stress. And I'm not going to explain exactly what that is, because it's not essential for my talk. What you can see is, what this means is that this is a number which is zero or positive. So So if this is number that's greater than or is equal to zero, then nu is, n0 is greater than or equal to nu. And so a slightly refined version is that just by counting the number of degrees of freedom and subtracting the number of constraints, I can get a lower bound on the number of zero modes. I didn't have to solve any equations of motion to do that. Kaladine provided a nice proof of this. So he said, I'm going to put this in quotes. It's not a full proof. So if I take that extension of spring M, I can expand it to linear order. In the displacement, so if you take a ground state, so some position where this is all those springs are in their rest configuration, then you can define the deviations. I don't know if this is mass 3 in the x direction and mass xy coordinates of the deviations of the masses from their equilibrium positions. So you can expand the extension of the spring in terms of these displacements, and you get a matrix Q. And dn minus nb turns out to be just the number, m is the number of I times a is the number of degrees of freedom. It's the columns of the matrix, and the rows, the number of rows in the matrix is the number of springs. And so this is going to be using some linear algebra. So if you just look at this matrix, the number of columns is the rank of the matrix plus the dimension of the null space. The number of rows in the matrix is the rank of the transpose matrix plus the dimension of the null space of the transpose matrix. And then there's this fundamental theorem of linear algebra, which says that these have to be the same. And so you get nullity of Q minus nullity Q transpose, and that's precisely N0 minus NSS. So no matter what you do with this matrix Q, you can't change this number nu, and that's the topology, right? Two things are the same just up to deformations of this matrix Q. The Hamiltonian is essentially expressed entirely in terms of this matrix Q, so you're deforming the Hamiltonian. You're not changing this matrix Q.
So, and not in NSS is how Kaladin defined this as a nullity of...
He didn't use his letters, but yes.
Right, but what I mean is that he, in his formulation, it's really a dimension of the null space of Q?
Yes. So he introduced this very nice matrix linear algebra understanding of what Maxwell did before, and that's how he was able to correct it. Kane and Lubensky understand there's a special case. And they highlighted the interesting importance of this special case. When nu equals zero and n0 equals zero for periodic boundary conditions, then it's then the system's gapped. And actually, it's more than gapped. There's a nice thing you can do with this. So they took the square rooting . So they are inspired by thinking about this problem going back to the 20s with Klein-Gordon and Dirac, and they they thought of taking the square root of the equations of motion. And so here's the square of a matrix. And this matrix right here, Q transpose Q, this comes from basically half kx squared from the springs, from the Hamiltonian. We expand this EM as I did over there in terms of Q, and this is the phonon equations of motion. And you think of this matrix, and so they introduce this other sector here, and you can think of this matrix as the square. This is just the square of another matrix. And instead of trying to study the problem from this perspective, this is Klein-Gordon. This is the square root of the equations of motion. And so instead of focusing on this eigenvalue problem, they focus on this eigenvalue problem. And when nu is equal to 0 and n0 is equal to 0, this problem is also gapped. If n0 alone is equal to 0, and maybe nu is something else, right, then still there's no 0 modes for the phonon, so this might be wrong. But this other sector has a problem. Okay? But so you've got these two sectors to worry about. So the special case happens here when you have both of these equal to 0, or when you have this NSS is 0 and N0 is 0. So the null spaces of both Q transpose and Q don't exist. They're 0. There are no vectors which live in the null space of this H. So that's that special case. And they found for the special case it has this particle hole-like symmetry. And it has a kind of time reversal symmetry. These are their formulas. So it's kind of time reversal symmetry and a kind of particle hole symmetry. And so they claim that this problem here, this H, is class BDI from the table of topological gapped fermion Hamiltonians.
Sorry, what's the dimension of Q again? So
dimension of Q. So Q has got rows and columns.
Uh-huh.
And it'll be twice the number of columns is twice the number of
what's
masses.
I
labels the masses here.
Okay.
And A is X or Y.
Okay. Uh-huh. And M?
And M is the number of springs. And with periodic boundary conditions, in the case we studied, for example, they were equal, so it's a square matrix. Any other case, it's not a square matrix. And from this class, they argue, therefore, there's a Z topological invariant. And so there must be edge modes. This is sounding a lot like generic kind of topological phenomena. So before I go into thinking about this, let me just this gives you enough to understand maybe the title of their paper, which was that the they titled their paper Topological Boundary Modes. In isostatic lattices. And this is the definition of isostatic. So, good.
So can you remind us what is an N0? I got lost a lot.
N0 is the number of zero modes. So being able to move the masses without changing the length of the springs.
NSS is the number.
And NSS is this other number that's positive or zero. It's the number of states of self-stress, which I haven't explained. I could explain it to you, but I got other things I want to explain.
So
it's
some property of
eigenvectors
of it's
by definition a null vector of the cube transpose. So mathematically, I can tell you exactly what it is, but I can also tell you physically what it is. It's not so complicated, but it's still. It was introduced by Callan in 1978, so it still took 100 and Maxwell was 1864, so it still took more than a century to really appreciate this other thing. But in any event,
Michael, question: is it possible to over-constrain the system such that the loop is actually magnetic?
Yes.
So then, in that sense, how would that work? Right? You're making a general argument that NSS is always positive, and not as larger than you. Can I make this?
This. If nu is negative, then n naught has to be greater than or equal to a negative number, but it's positive, so it's always just has to be. It's even more. It has to be greater than zero, obviously, as well. So as soon as you have more masses and more springs, that constrain the motion of the masses, you can get rid of your zero modes. So that explains one. So you might think of some questions based on their work. How generic is this? And if you added in one more spring, you change the dimensions of these matrices. It's a different problem. And that problem, you add one more spring to this, you immediately, the new problem, so if you had zero, nu equals zero, so nu is equal to zero with periodic boundary conditions, but now let's suppose I put one more spring in the problem, then this nu will be negative, and so there is a vector in the null space of Q transpose, so that means the gap in this model vanishes. You add one more spring, and this all this nice formal stuff I just went through, you end up with a Hamiltonian which has a zero mode. Yeah.
And what is the zero mode actually in this case?
With this open boundary conditions?
Yes.
My second question. So first question is how generic is this? Well, I didn't change the symmetry. I just added a spring. And so within the number of springs I've had, it's completely generic. But I add one more spring and it's different. And I don't see how that's related to symmetry. It's just something I've done to the Hamiltonian. So that's why I argue this. Any degeneracy we're finding here is an accidental degeneracy, but it's still can be interesting even if it's not generic, fully generic. Now the next question is. So what is this zero mode? And a third question might be, before I actually answer that question, let me ask one more question. Let me just add this. This is class BDI from a table of fermion Hamilton, topology of gapped fermion Hamiltonians. What are the fermions here? This is balls and springs we're talking about. It turns out I'm going to answer this question accidentally later on in the talk. But that's another question you might think of. So let me get to your question, Frank. So what is this zero mode? So actually, this was studied. So all of this analysis we've just done here relies on this expanding to linear order. And there are other people who study these soft kind of things. And it turns out, so very soon after Kane Lubetzky came up with this paper, somebody basically built this model, this chain, using Lego or something similar. You can just build it out of Lego. They called it a fancy name, metamaterial. But you can just build this, and you can study what the, actually the what the zero mode is just by. So let me pretend I build this out of Lego. So here's one spring, another one beam. So these are beams. You know, something like this. Anyway, so something like this. And so there's one. When you open the boundary conditions, there's one zero mode. And turns out there's a kind of polarization that happens when you open these boundary conditions. And the mode, if you build this, and you start with basically the configuration that you might have written down for periodic boundary conditions, you'll find an edge state on one edge, but not the other edge. Sorry. This counting that I went through didn't say anything about where things are located. Yep.
Is the positioning of the fixed masses of any relevance in this setup?
So these are all, in principle, I haven't decided on which edge it would arise on. So you can make sure that you haven't really biased the system based on exactly how you've positioned the masses. From that perspective, then no, basically none of this has to do with any of the values of the spring constants, locations of the masses and their rest positions. It's a topological argument. It doesn't depend on these details. You'll find it shows up, say, on one edge and not the other edge. And so that's a little bit interesting. But then, when you build it out of Lego, this is where you discover something much more interesting than that. It turns out, so if you try to move one of these masses, you'll find it's rigid in the bulk, as I suggested. On the edge, you'll find it's soft. But then, if you keep pushing it, it moves directly into the bulk with ease. And it just transports through the system without any trouble at all. And Kane and Lubensky missed this. They called it a topological boundary mode. But when you think about the problem in a more non-linear way, the zero mode existed beyond the linear order. And as you try to move in the direction of that zero mode, you just keep changing the configurations of these masses and springs, and doesn't cost any energy, and so the domain walls themselves are mobile in this system. It's not just that you get sort of topological mode within the linear order. To nonlinear order, you get the domain wall itself. So if you think about, I've been thinking about maybe analogy.
Domain wall means what?
Domain wall or edge state.
Domain wall doesn't mean edge state.
If you think about trying to understand this with, say, a Dirac Hamiltonian, where you make the mass switch from negative to positive, the location of that switch itself can change as you move around the possible ground state configurations. So maybe to try to paint a picture. Let me just make some high dimensional, so this is x1, x y1. So these are the coordinates of different masses. It's a really high dimensional space. There's some, one-dimensional zero-mode space. And when you start with one state and you expand, around it, you see all of the physics that I just described, but you can move along this path in the space of configurations, and that's this domain wall that's been that's propagating through the that can propagate through the bulk of the system. Yep.
Michael, did you start by telling us that this isostatic condition means that there are no zero modes?
Yeah, isostatic means no zero modes for periodic boundary conditions. So then I open the boundary conditions and I get a zero mode.
I see. So if somebody, if you were actually to make periodic boundary conditions and glue the edges of the label, and you try now to move, the thing would be completely rigid?
Right. Exactly.
So should I really think of this as a sort of zero energy phonon, a soft phonon that can propagate through the entire system if I open up the boundary?
Yeah, it's a zero energy phonon, exactly. And if you look at the linearized phonons around that any one configuration, any one ground state, you'll see all the stuff you're familiar with quadratic problems. But there's this nonlinear. You keep moving around, and you can keep moving around the space, and your domain, basically this domain wall or this edge, propagates right through the bulk in that when you do that. So there's something more to this topology than the topology of quadratic of the quadratic phonon problem. There's one more question, which is actually at the end of. At the end of Kane Lebensky's paper, they said, so what does this have to do with, they said it would be interesting to explore connections to the physics of, or the connections to frustrated magnetism. And then they cited my paper, which is this first paper I wrote down here, which came before their work. And actually, so what I'm going to be able to show you now is trying to answer that question. So the rest of my talk, I wanted to answer the question of how can I port this physics of phonons and balls and springs over to magnetic systems. And you may wonder why. I mean, it's nice always to port something from one realm to another realm. Because when you do that, you might the new area might have more some advantages the old area doesn't have. In this case, it turns out, I believe at least, the new area has quite a huge advantage the old area doesn't have. So magnetism has a major advantage that the balls and springs does not have. So you can think about a phase diagram parameterized by this topological index nu. When nu is equal to zero, that's the case we've been focusing on, or nu very close to zero. If nu is less than zero, then you have extra constraints. So this is the rigid system. This is a bridge that won't collapse. And if nu is greater than zero, then you have a floppy system. So this is a rigidity transition. If you were to think of being able to somehow tune nu, you would go from a rigid system to a floppy system, generically. Generically within this, without adding extra springs or something. Somehow, some kind of generic. What would be the magnetic analog of this? So if we had a similar thing happening with magnetic systems, for example, this end might be anti-ferromagnetic ordered. The rigidity would be the spins are stuck, right, in some pattern. But if you made nu greater than zero, then I'll just be provocative. You would end up with something where the spins are floppy, a spin liquid.
The classical spin liquid.
What's that?
The classical spin liquid.
This would be, we are starting here from a kind of classical spin liquid. Everything I've talked about is pretty classical. I'll discuss how maybe some of this isn't as classical as you might think. This would be at the large S limit. You could add in S here, and you could wonder whether, as you went down in S, somehow this is connected to something happening down. So, so for solid state systems, how many solids do you know are floppy? Right? On the other hand, for magnetic systems, we have a lot, you know, long history of trying to study floppy magnetism. It's called highly frustrated magnetism. And so, so there's a huge advantage if we could port this over to magnetism, because we could be able to study it within solid state physics. We wouldn't have to build it out of Lego or something. It might be a property of some material.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
I have a problem about somehow. Isn't there some kind of a nice continuous way of actually changing this new by adding a spring that is very loose, and you will just change this new? And there's a phase transition going on here.
Yeah. This new. So I've been a little loose here. So one way you could think of it is you start with too many springs, too many springs, right? And then you remove a random spring here and there. And you would weaken the system and go through this transition. But if you had a soft spring, or this is just about the this is about the zero modes, you'd have to, probably a soft spring still qualifies as a spring, as far as what the exact zero energy manifold is about. It wouldn't care about how soft the spring is. So I agree, I'm being rather vague on the details of how you might actually really think about this in the context of a single model where you're really tuning new. I'm just trying to present the idea that for magnetic systems, we can easily go from new being negative to new being positive. And let me be actually more concrete about that. But that's the main point I'm trying to make here. That there are plenty of magnetic systems which are floppy. The spins are just not as constrained. And that's where we try to look for spin liquids. Anyway, so there's a long history in our field of being able to study sort of both sides of this problem. So if we want to now make that leap, go from rigid, from balls and springs to magnetism, we need to have a magnetic analog of springs. Actually, it's not that hard to do. Consider the Heisenberg model in the square lattice. You can always replace this with this Hamiltonian plus the constant here. And now this looks like this half kx squared situation. And you can think of this as the total spin on a bond with the vector direction x, y, or z, alpha. So this is the direct analog of that extension of the spring. And so we can keep going on the triangular lattice. Here's one thing you can do. You can take the sum over each triangle, the total spin in each triangle squared, and you get the Heisenberg model in the triangular lattice. Kagami lattice is similar. Up to a factor of 2. Pyrochor lattice. There are tetrahedron in the pyrochor lattice, the sum of the total spin is tetrahedron squared. You can form the Heisenberg model on the pyrochor lattice. And there's even another case, J2 equals J1 over 2 point on the square lattice. And you can make the sum of each, the spin in each square, total sum of each spin in each square, squared. That introduces second neighbor interactions with precisely half the strength of the nearest neighbor interactions. So these are examples of how we can take Heisenberg models and write them in a very similar way that we could study balls and springs. And we can even go with this. We can plot these models on this space of nu, and we find the square. This is a nu divided by a number of sites. And these different problems fall onto this axis, where Kagame turns out precisely, yeah, each spin has 2 degrees of freedom times the number of sites, which is 3 in each unit cell. Each triangle has 3 components of the spin, the total spin in each triangle, times the number of triangles in each unit cell, which is 2. And so Kagame is an example where it's precisely 0. And so just by scanning through different lattices, we can move from the rigid kind of situation to a floppy situation. And if I define my total spin on a simplex, I can always expand it in terms of a matrix. Introduce coordinates that parameterize the deviations of the spins from their ground state spin pattern. And I again have the same matrix that we had for the balls and springs case. And so this nu here is precisely, what I've used here is precisely the, so it's 2 times the number of sites minus 3 times the number of simplexes. And this ends up being nullity of A minus nullity of A transpose. But there's a problem with this which bothered me. And that is, if you look at the equations of motion for this X, if I write it in terms of matrices, the quadratic form you have to solve, the eigenvalue problem you have to solve is not one with a symmetric matrix. This matrix, this looks like a symmetric matrix, but this X is in phase space Q and P, and this is the Poisson bracket. And so you're trying to diagonalize a problem where the eigenvalue problem is not that of a symmetric matrix. And one of the features of that problem is it doesn't always have eigenvectors. And so I wasn't really sure how or whether this argument, Kaladin's argument, really holds for this problem. So that kind of bothered me and prevented me from sort of publishing this stuff for a little while. And then I was reading Kay Levinsky's paper, and they start talking a lot about, there's this question about fermions, and this question of, and the structure of these different matrices, this H squared, these different matrices that entered the problem they studied. And they discuss how this problem actually has a kind of supersymmetry associated with it, where one sector kind of get mapped to another sector. One sector you think of as fermions, another sector you think of as bosons. Let me not go into details, but so they invoked the idea of supersymmetry, which has been used in quantum mechanics to study their eigenvalue problem. And this got me thinking about maybe we could try to understand this with supersymmetry. And to be honest, I still don't really understand how I came up with the following argument, the following proof. So here's another proof of this topological index. It was not in Kano-Lubansky's paper, but it was inspired by the word supersymmetries that I was seeing in the paper. So define the following. This is a different Q than I was defining earlier. Sorry. For every constraint condition, so the total spin in the x direction is 0 or something in a simplex, for every one of those constraint conditions, introduce another degree of freedom, I'll call it gamma. Take the sum, this is a upper index and lower index, Einstein summation is convention is assumed. And I can define what I'm going to call a supersymmetric charge, Q, to be this quantity. And I'm going to define a supersymmetric Hamiltonian. So right now I'm working with classical physics, but this all holds also if I use anti-commutators, and these are quantum operators. So I take basically the anti-commutator of Q is itself times a half. And I can write this in the following way. This is the Poisson bracket of an angular momentum with another angular momentum. So it satisfies, this is just typical angular momentum commutation relations. This, on the other hand, needs to be defined. And so if I choose this, to be an exchange constant matrix, then this first term is just the Heisenberg model. And it gives an algebra for these gammas. So, and it turns, this is a symmetric matrix. Positive, I want it to be a positive matrix. That means the eigenvalues are all positive. So it's a well-defined metric, and this is symmetric, so these must be, if I'm in the classical side, these must be Grassmann variables. If I'm in the quantum side, they must be Majorana fermions. And so the exchange constant matrix itself behaves like a metric for these fermions. And then if I expand around the ground state, this is going to be just a constant. This was already a constant. I have two quadratic Hamiltonians. They don't see each other. So I've introduced fermions, but they don't interact with the bosons. And so they can be completely thought of as completely fictitious degrees of freedom. Then, staring at this matrix, it turns out these are variables which are equal to zero in the ground state. This is a matrix which was introduced by Dirac. Which you call it the constraint matrix. If you wanted to constrain the problem to its ground state and study that problem, then this matrix plays an important role in the description of that problem. And Dirac introduced this when he was trying to generalize constraints, holonomic constraints in configuration space to similar kind of thing in phase space. I won't go too much into the details, but it turns out this is precisely the matrix I studied in my paper over there. This is the one that Kane and Lubensky referred to at the end of their paper. And it turns out it's also, if you do this whole business on the phonon side, it's also the same thing as the it's the analog of this matrix H that they studied, this Dirac Hamiltonian. And so here's the connection that they met. They were wondering about connections of what they did to frustrated magnetism. It falls right out of this structure of the supersymmetry, where I've added extra Fermion degrees of freedom to the problem, and end up with two problems, a Heisenberg model and a bosonic model and a fermionic model, and new partners for the phonons or magnons, these magnenos or phoninos, the gamma particles.
So in a classical system, how would you define this latter part being fermionic? In what sense is it fermionic?
They're Grassmann variables.
Okay, so it really only makes sense for the example that you're writing here in terms of the space. Right, I mean, if you were given a classical system for which there was some holonomic constraints on a Dirac, right, and they were incorporated in this matrix H, the gammas that sandwich this matrix on the side, they wouldn't be fermions, right? Or would you...
So when Kane and Lubensky took that square root from the Klein-Gordon to the Dirac, they didn't talk about what the degrees of freedom were. So I argue the degrees of freedom are these gammas.
And they're actually Grassmannian, even though...
They're Grassmannian. Well, actually, I pulled something slightly. So this matrix they wrote down, you have to put a minus sign here. It has to be anti-symmetric matrix. But that's actually... this tau z that commuted with the Hamiltonian. So it's a minor point. Okay, now I've got a supersymmetric problem. There's something called the Witten index.
Sorry, that Hamiltonian is an anti-symmetric matrix? So
this Hamiltonian is anti-symmetric.
It can only be Hamiltonian for fermion?
Yeah, it's the right. It's the fermion Hamiltonian.
So that's the Hamiltonian Kane and Lubensky have.
This is the Hamiltonian Kane and Lubensky started. I multiply by this tau z, and I get the same thing here.
Uh-huh.
Make it anti.
So tau z is what you multiply.
Right. So it's not precisely the same, but it's the same eigenvalue problem.
Okay.
In essence, they're trivially related, the eigenvalue problems. So in a supersymmetric problem, there's something called the Witten index, which is the number of bosons, the boson states, minus the number of fermions. And you can think of this here, where this is a many-body supersymmetry, but if I apply it to just a single particle sector, this is the number of the x I use number of gamma m alphas, which is precisely this 2n I can show that this Q, which maps eigenmodes from one problem, boson problem, to eigenmodes in the fermion problem, that this precisely equals to this quantity here. So I was able to show, using the supersymmetry, and supersymmetry tells you how to map a state from your boson sector to a state to your fermion sector. So I won't go into details, but you can prove, I was able to prove that this Witten index is the Maxwell-Calladine index. They're the same thing. So let me spend the last few minutes trying to apply this to maybe something of, so now if we're able to extend all of this nice topological physics to frustrated magnetism, what might we see on that in some materials? I mean, we've been working on trying to find materials where this kind of physics might be present.
So before you get there, actually, so what's the symmetry here, and what's the symmetry here? What's the class? So does it correspond to any class in tenfold wave table, or what's that?
Let me come back to that. Okay. I'm a little confused about it because the symmetry class that we discussed for that chain gives you a Z topological index.
Yeah.
And it seems that the Z topological index that they wrote down works fine in any dimension, not just one dimension.
Right, so this has nothing to do with dimensionality yet, right?
It doesn't seem to have anything to do with dimensionality, and yet there still is this. It might be a point where this stuff coincides with the table, but maybe there are other cases where it doesn't. At the same time, I have not understood really the answer to your question in depth, but I will show you some more details, at least, of what I do understand.
Question?
Yeah.
So for the Kagama, is it correct that the classical ground state manifold is actually infinitely degenerate, mm-hmm. that there is a...
Yes. So that's precisely... It's right here, right underneath my title. So for the Kagame case, which we like, which is nu equals zero, there's a problem. And that is that for Kagame, n0 is much greater than 1, let alone zero, not 0. So that means this NSS, or NS, whatever the NSS was, is also much greater than 1, so that nu equals 0. It's in a realm where we're not close to this generic. So what is generic here? Generic, as I change this matrix A, right, this nu cannot change. So I should be able to find a matrix A where this nu is 0 for Kagame case. But if I just look at the nearest neighbor Kagame problem, this nullity of A is huge. It's got all these 0 modes. So those 0 modes are not this nu being greater than 0. They're sort of more accidental in this sense.
But actually, so when you say and not much greater than 1, does this scale linearly with the system size? Or?
It scales with the volume of the system size. I'll explain actually in more detail in a second. So our solution is to distort. So don't go after the ideal Kagame problem. Go after a distorted Kagame problem. And you can do that by generalizing this SM alpha here. I'm not summing over these indices. And so I basically change the length of this spin. Still, I want the total vector sum here to vanish in the ground state. And this ends up giving us an exchange matrix, which is something like this. So I can change the exchange constant in different bonds, but I can still write the problem in exactly the same structure. Just I change the way the form of the constraints. And when I do that, as I tune through the different values of A, I'm tuning through different matrices, capital A. And so to give a physical picture of what's going on, actually, there's a really nice way to understand it. You can solve this sum of this, so if you take the ideal case, so AI equals 1, for example, if you take the sum of the spins around a triangle, you can solve that by introducing new variables, which are vectors in three-dimensional space, called heights. It's kind of height model. So you can express this, the total spin in a triangle as the difference between two sites, and here I have Kagame problem. So So this is my, these are my three spins. Total spin wants to be zero. I express it in terms of three vectors that live on the centers of the hexagons, and I must impose, because the spin is a unit vector, the distance between any of these two sites must be equal to one. But you see, if you introduce these three points, if the distance between these three points is one, you can work with the points of these three points of these triangles, move the triangle in three-dimensional space, and you move the directions of these vectors without changing their lengths. And so you can introduce these heights to explore the ground state of the Kagome-Antich ferromagnet. And if you work it all out for many sites, it turns out you can just draw, let me see, I did it here, you can draw the spins. Unfold this here. So you can draw a spin pattern, and then you can fold this spin pattern. And any folded pattern tells you, if you look at the direction of that spin, that would be the direction in three dimensions in this room. The direction of spin in this room, that would be the direction of the spin on your lattice. And if you took all those directions, put them on a lattice, you would get a ground state of the Kagome antiferromagnet. So you can parameterize them by folding this sheet of paper. And at first, if you have a flat sheet of paper, you can only fold along lines without tearing the paper. So it looks like the number grows with the linear size of the system. But if you keep folding down to a little triangle, then you have this triangle has lots of different ways that you can unfold it, and it grows with the volume. It turns out to grow with the volume of the system. So what happens then when we distort? Well, what happens then is the lengths that you needed on this triangle become longer or shorter, and you end up with an origami that may not be a flat sheet of paper to begin with. And so you can make it rigid. You can try to make it rigid, at least, by trying to make a distorted Kagome be an origami sheet of paper which you can't flatten. And so it may not have all these zero modes. And then there's a really neat thing that happens. It turns out we still don't get rid of all the zero modes. So if you Fourier transform this matrix, you can get a matrix in the Brillouin zone, and because it's a square matrix, you can take the determinant of this matrix. So that gives you a function on your Brillouin zone. And it turns out there's some literature in the soft condensed matter community that's just coming out the last couple of months. I still don't understand the analytic proof, but there is an empirical proof of the following statement. This determinant of A is essentially real. So it maps the Brillouin zone to a real number. There's an overall phase, because this is a complex matrix, right? A Fourier transform is a complex matrix. It's an overall phase, but up to an overall phase, it's a real number. And it's just an ordinary regular function in the Brillouin zone. A regular function that's real in the Brillouin zone will generally be positive and negative. So let me draw a picture. Here's my Brillouin. Let's suppose this was my Brillouin zone. So this is something we've found. In one case, because it's real, there's going to be places where det A is greater than 0, less than 0, greater than 0, less than 0. If you have spin rotation invariants, you always are going to get a zero mode at the gamma point just associated with global spin rotations. But for any generic distortion of this origami sheet, this reality property holds, and this was studied. So on the mechanical side, this was studied by generating thousands of origami sheets and just checking is this real for this sheet? Is it real? And they sound for all 1,000 or 10,000 or something sheets that generated, it's real. But then recently somebody proved it analytically. So there's a theorem, I guess, that the determinant of this A of K is actually real. And so generally you will get line note, because whenever this is equal to zero, that means there's a zero mode in the problem. So you'll get line nodes in general in a generic spin origami distort, or just generic distorted Kagame, as long as I can make it fit this pattern of. So I'm writing a paper right now with Krishnu Roy Chowdhury and Zeb Rocklin, so it's in preparation, where we argue that these kind of things can happen in real Kagome materials. If you violate this origami condition so that you don't have this going to a real number, it would go to a complex number, and what would happen is generically, instead of having lines, vial lines, you'd have vial points instead. So there's sort of a more general Kagome antiferromagnet may not have vial lines, but they might have vial points. But either case, this sounds quite interesting.
Sorry, just to translate language. So when you have like a line nodes, it means that the ground state will be scaled
zero.
Linearly. So what the meaning of line nodes actually? So I thought the Kagome is the ground state is actually scaled linear with system size.
Yeah. That was before I distorted.
Sorry?
That was before I distorted.
Okay, after the
generic distortion will still have these line notes.
Okay, so what does it mean physically? It still means that there's a massive degenerate ground state, or?
There are a line, yeah, the degeneracy still goes with the linearly in the system size, because it's a line
note. Then we have a point, we have a wild point.
Then it's just a fixed number.
Okay.
So for the spin origami fancy case, then you can get line nodes. For the more generic case of just a distorted Kagome antiferromagnet with SU2 symmetry and just nearest neighbor couplings, you will get, generically you'll get vial points. This is a generic argument. It doesn't have to be that there are vial points. It depends whether this function passes from positive to negative values. But without looking at details, just thinking about these class of models, you'll find one. And actually, it turns out it's pretty common. So, in the cases we've been studying that are related to some materials, it seems to happen there. All right. Let me just conclude. Oh, sorry, before I conclude, one more thing. This is all at the linear order. So what happens beyond linear? Is there an analog of this mobile domain walls? This is still only analysis at the linear order, so there might be something even more interesting than having lines of zero modes in a bosonic system. So I've argued this topology of frustration, a phrase I'm using, it's a universal phenomena. That is, we went from mechanical to spin systems. In this case, I introduced fermions, so actually those are Majorana fermions. You might wonder if there's also some relationship of this to superconductivity. And that's where I hinted at one point that there may be some relations of this more deeply to the quantum problems. So if you were to come at this where the somehow from the angle where the fermions were the physical degrees of freedom, and you introduced the bosons just to understand the fermion problem, I don't see why that also wouldn't work. So it seemed to connect very different problems. There's topological phenomena, or topologically protected phenomena, beyond Dan, agree? That seems interesting. But there's a cost. Generic perturbations. Destabilize the infrared. There's always going to be some longer range in a solid state system. There'll always be some longer range spring or longer range interactions. And so I guess I kind of think of this as I was coming down in energy. Here's like the nearest neighbor scale. I enter one class of problems, topological class of problems. I go past, say, the second neighbor. I might enter another class. And eventually, it will become trivial, which is the third law of thermodynamics. So, thank you for your attention.
So this is all classical, so what happens if you kind of put some quantum corrections on top?
Yeah, so that's generic. So this is accidental degeneracy, right? So you can ask, quantum fluctuations, they will not generally preserve that degeneracy, and so they will split the degeneracy. So this axis here, these perturbations, which I've just labeled J1, they may also be thought of as the strength of the quantum fluctuations. At some point, your quantum fluctuations, you'll sense the splitting of the degeneracy by quantum fluctuations. But that's from the point of view of this balls and springs and the magnetic problem. And it's also a question of what would those quantum fluctuations do in this case. This is sort of a more, so what happens in the traditional situation of when we have this accidental degeneracy, is quantum fluctuations split it, and you pick a ground state to expand around. So there's one that's preferred to all the others. That's what typically happens. But this is a more refined version of accidental degeneracy. So exactly what phenomena sort of are preserved, how it gets destroyed, is still not well understood. If you come at this where the fermions were the original physical degrees of freedom and try to understand the problem from that end, then you're directly into some quantum end, and so there's no sense to what. So there should be some analogs in the quantum side, but it's not the same problems that I've been discussing today.
Okay, there's no more question. Let's thank Michael again.